Hare Krishna, we're talking about men. Well, actually, we're talking about women, but we're also talking about men, and we're talking about women, men, and sexuality and Krishna consciousness. And last week, at the end of the session, Rasa Rasika asked a question about how do you balance grihastha life when it seems, at least from his perspective, the male perspective, that sometimes he has to do things which are make it difficult for him to be Krishna conscious. And I gave an answer without going into details, basically saying it's a bit of a juggling act, it's not always easy. And I wanted to mention that that's not the only answer, of course, and there are many things that can be done. But rather than describe all those things that can be done, I wanted to mention that there is a Grihastha division team in ISKCON. And I just read last week that they have teleconferences every week. And as far as I know, you can ask questions of them. So any issues pertaining to family life, they're the experts. So I don't want to, well, Vaishnava, what's the website? VaishnavaFamilyResources.org. So I don't think it's really, I'm going to really get into it so much. We may. But at this point, we're talking more generally, not particularly about Grihastha life, but in general, the cultural perspectives and spiritual perspectives on male-female relationships and how it can help or hinder Krishna consciousness. So naturally, Grihastha life will come up in there, but these people are better than I am. So if you remember, I didn't give a detailed answer. I didn't get specific about things that could be done, but I gave a general answer that every ashram has its own difficulties. And sometimes in grihastha life, there's a balance that you have to make, and sometimes that means there's compromises, and it's not necessarily always ideal for one's spiritual life. And I think that's what Rasa Rasika was asking. And I was just saying, basically, it's a reality of that ashram that there'll be other things that one has to do, which also is why some men who can, who are able, remain renounced, because they see that the nature of married life is that there will be things that will take time away from hearing and chanting and direct service. And when you're married, it definitely is a balancing act and a compromise. But anyway, I just wanted to say that because I answered it in a specific way purposely, but it didn't deal with any practical application or suggestions to answer that question. So who's with me? Manjesh, this is me. I've never been with this is me before. Kremlin is back. Good to see your name there, Kremlin. And Spiritual Sky and Bhakti Craig. Wow. Wonderful. So I've been welcomed back. I wish I didn't come back. And Vrindavan and Mayapur were so nice that I should have stayed there forever. And I recommend all of you go there as soon as you can, as quickly as you can, and stay there as long as you can. It is the real panacea for spiritual life to go to the Holy Dham, because Krishna consciousness is alive and well in the Holy Dham. That's for sure. Okay. Bhakti and Carol, glad you're with us. Okay, so if you weren't here last week, what we're doing is reading an article. And the way this discussion on this topic is going to go, mainly, at least for a while, is that I'm reading discussion. I'm reading articles. They're not my articles, and I'm commenting on them. And I'm not representing that these articles are absolute and perfect, and I'm opening these discussions up to you if you don't agree or you want to discuss something. I'm not presenting anything here as absolute. But we're only presenting for the sake of discussion and trying to get a deeper understanding of issues dealing with men, women, and sexuality and Krishna consciousness. Now, last week we began reading an article called Women and, let me see what it's called. It's called Women's Spiritual Nature. Unfortunately, I don't know who wrote it, but I very much appreciate the devotee who wrote it. It's a god sister of mine. And what we read last week was we're dealing with what I would say some of the red flags in dealing with women, the things that Prabhupada said. Women are less intelligent. They shouldn't be given independence. They're like children. They should be protected by men. They should always be under the care of an older man, either the father, the husband, or the elder son. And so in this article, this woman is addressing these points. And in it, she's saying if she had no acquaintance with Krishna consciousness and she had no acquaintance with Prabhupada, when she would read all these things, she would just think this is another patriarchal, chauvinistic religious movement who wants to keep women down, who wants men who want to control women. So she begins to address this issue by understand, but first she addresses the fact that we're not the body. So we want to get that clear in the beginning. And so we understand, okay, men and women are the same, but we're dealing with the body and the culture and of how to deal with male and female. And also, because we're dealing with the body, how to act in that body, what's the right way, what's the psychology, the male psychology, the female psychology, and what's compatible. So she was making the point that Krishna is the Purusha, we are Prakriti, or the enjoyed, and the Purusha is the male, and the Prakriti is the female. So even in the material world, even though there is Krishna as Purusha and Radha as Prakriti, or the enjoyed, in the material world also, it's reflected in the male psychology and the female psychology. So she began saying that the male psychology of the enjoyer and the female psychology of the enjoyed, or the servant of the male, is also there. So she began talking a little bit about that. And I recommend, if you weren't here last week, then go and listen to that after this class. Is it up there? Yeah, it's up there on Krishna.com under video, right? Mahatma video or audio or both. It's under, should be under view. Go to TV and then, is that right? View, TV. I'm just looking at it now so I can tell you. View TV, we're waiting for it to come up. And then you will see, you just click on, there's a picture of me and it says women, men, and sexuality and Krishna consciousness. And then you can hear it. So I recommend that. Okay, so now we're going to continue reading. And so we're basically been talking a lot about the Purusha and the Prakriti, the enjoyer, Krishna as the enjoyer, and Radha as the Prakriti, or the enjoyed. So I'm going to read a little bit of what we read. Now she's talking about Radharani and how Radharani manifests as Durga, and that whole female or feminine nature manifests and what that is. Sri Radha, who is the embodiment of spiritual love of God, expands herself into an inferior manifestation, the embodiment of the material energy, or Durga Devi, the goddess of matter. As the embodiment of matter, she allures the souls and invites them to come and enjoy her. In this way, she binds them through the agency of sex, or the attraction between men and women, to material existence. She is also called the illusory energy, or Maya, since the pleasure she offers is ephemeral and factually filled with suffering. While Sri Radha reflects the nature of surrender, service, and feminine love for the Purusha, Durga Devi reflects the opposite aspect of feminine nature, sexual, seducing, and cunning, in need of the Purusha, the man, to attract, charm, and bewilder. So, is that the nature of every woman? Well, perhaps to some degree. Sexual, seducing, and cunning, in need of a man. So she's just making that point that nature, I don't want to say infects, but that's to some degree the nature of women, through at least the more bewildered they are, the more they want to be sexually attractive to men. Those souls who are attracted to material existence are therefore souls who choose to deny their prakriti nature and to disconnect themselves from their relationship with the Lord, and are now trying to establish their position as the Purusha, the enjoyer and controller, the center for whose pleasure everything is meant. All of us want the same thing, to become the Purusha, to gain control as much as we can over the resources of material energy and over each other for our own selfish pleasure. For this reason, our entire existence is characterized by a struggle for supremacy and power, and the existential law is that the strong exploit the weak. So, Krishna's Purusha, we're all Prakriti, we come to the material world, we want to imitate Krishna and become the Purusha. Even the female wants to be Purusha. We want to be the center. Take Krishna out of the center and put ourselves in the center. Since we try to imitate here the divine play of love, along our karmic journey, some of us sometimes assume the role of the Purusha, the enjoyer, while others play Prakriti, the giver of joy, in other words, the male and the female. The male body represents the Purusha, autonomous and independent, and the female body represents Prakriti, subordinate and defined by the Purusha. Thus, there are two kinds of natures or ego, different from each other and simultaneously attracted to each other, and in a proper environment, also complementing each other. So here she's making the point that the male and female psychology or ego are a little different, and they can compete or they can complement one another, depending on how we deal with them. Or you could say in the most natural environment or the most healthy environment, they would complement one another. Religious injunctions are essentially meant to demarcate and minimize the tendency towards egocentricity and the strife for supremacy, as well as to enable cooperation and regulation of the sexual tension between the two genders or two types of ego. I'm going to read that again because this is important. Religious injunctions are essentially meant to demarcate and minimize the tendency towards egocentricity and the strife for supremacy, as well as to enable cooperation and regulation of the sexual tension between the two genders or two types of ego. In any case, in the present age, Kali Yuga, the influence of the mode of goodness is constantly declining, while that of the modes of passion and ignorance is on the rise. Consequently, sense gratification is taken to be the ultimate goal of life, and the entire atmosphere becomes saturated with self-interest, hypocrisy, and callousness. In such a state, the principles of religion are often used to justify egocentricity, and even as a method for exploitation, abuse, and control of the strong over the weak gender. A woman is perceived as a means to satisfy the sexual needs of her husband and as a mother for his children, in negation of all independence and freedom to fulfill herself beyond that. This is really interesting because what she's saying is that men will take advantage of what they perceive as religious or scriptural injunctions, that the woman should be subservient to the man. And I don't know if I told the story, but I probably did, and you may remember that one devotee had been reading Srila Prabhupada's books in which Prabhupada said that the wife should serve the husband, be subservient, be submissive. That's the general Vedic principle or paradigm for a wife. Is the vision you get is a woman who doesn't speak back to her husband, who's very kind, is very gentle, does what her husband wants, just tries to make him happy. So this devotee went to Prabhupada and said, therefore, Prabhupada, after reading all this, does it mean my wife should do whatever I tell her? And Prabhupada said, and you should be so arrogant. So what he read in the Shastra made him think, well, my position as the husband is that my wife should basically just be very close to something like a slave. And then I determine how much mercy I give her, how much slack I give her. And she doesn't really have a right to complain about it. She just has to accept it and make me happy because her life is really dedicated to making me happy. So, of course, we know better than that, but based on reading all the things that are in Shastra, some men may interpret it that way, and particularly men who want to interpret it that way. So here the author of this article is making the point that men take advantage of these kinds of injunctions, and they misunderstand them, and they want to subordinate women to almost the point of slaves, or if not slaves. And that, of course, is not the purpose of the injunctions. But it's a danger, and it's a common danger. So now she's talking about feminism as a reaction to this. The feminist fight for women's liberation takes part in the struggle of the entire modern world to free itself from the burden of religious oppression. In other words, the idea of women being subordinate to men is perceived, either falsely or rightly, as coming from conservative religious ideas. And so the feminist movement is to fight against this oppression. They see it as a chauvinistic, patriarchal, oppressive. It's wrong. It's antiquated. It's primitive. And if we women don't do something about it, then men will take advantage of it. And even men who are not religious will take advantage of it in the sense that these ideas filter into society, become part of the social milieu. Feminist fight for women's liberation takes part in the struggle of the entire modern world to free itself from the burden of religious oppression. The modern person defines himself or herself through the right for freedom, the freedom to fulfill oneself without the strict and confining laws of religion, the freedom to enjoy without fearing sin, the freedom to control one's destiny, the freedom to explore the truth, and even the freedom to believe or not in the existence of God. So we could also look at this point from the male perspective, because she's making the point, we want the freedom not to believe in Scripture or to believe in it the way we want to or to believe in what we want to. I believe in this, but I don't believe in that. So it's not just an issue of feminism, but it's also an issue from the men's point of view. And as we pointed out last week, many of the men like feminism because the women become independent. And therefore, part of that independence is that the women want to enjoy sexual freedom because they see men are free to enjoy sex. Why shouldn't we be? So the men like that women are independent, liberated, because then they can enjoy sex without any obligation, without any responsibility. And they don't even have to pay for it. What a deal. Okay, we have a comment from Spiritual Sky who says, the feminist movement was a brilliant design to get women into the workforce, collect more taxes, send kids to public school for indoctrination, and to break up the family unit. Wow, Spiritual Sky must be a politician. What a statement. And to enable men to enjoy women rather than just getting married and having one wife and being responsible. No. There are all these women out there. Prabhupada said, I don't know if I mentioned this last week, Prabhupada said, in Vedic culture, you couldn't just go up and talk to women. You couldn't hang out with women. The only women you could talk to were the prostitutes. And so they dressed a certain way, and then you know they were prostitutes. So if you talk to them, that's perfectly okay. But you couldn't be hanging out with other women. So just the idea of being able to enjoy sex with any woman other than a prostitute was impossible, at least very difficult, because you didn't really have the culture, you didn't have access to them. And then, what to speak of Muslim culture, where the women are completely dressed, even if you wanted to enjoy them, you wouldn't know which one to enjoy because you couldn't even see them. You wouldn't even know if they were 12 years old or 85 years old. So that protected the women, and it protected society from illicit connection with women. It's an interesting concept, of course. I think it says something about the ability of men to control themselves, that men should be strong enough to be able to see women and control themselves. There was a time when the devotees had written a letter to Srila Prabhupada, and they were complaining that in the temple, both the men and the women in the morning would chant their rounds together, and the men preferred the women wouldn't be there. So Prabhupada didn't like that. He was upset that the men should feel that way. And he said, everywhere you go outside, there are women everywhere. So basically he was saying, you just have to be mature enough to be chaste in your mind and your heart, and kind of like grow up boys, you know, everywhere you go, there's women. And Srila Prabhupada said that when he grew up, in the culture he grew up, he said, you weren't allowed to speak to women. And he said that as young boys, we naturally wanted to speak to them, but culturally it was taboo. So we couldn't. So therefore, there was no possibility, or as I said, unlikely there would be any intimate connection between men and women, because you couldn't even speak to them. So, and Prabhupada, he made the point, and he said, well, we were attracted to them and we wanted to speak to them, but we couldn't. It wasn't allowed. So I think what Prabhupada's saying is internally men need to be controlled, because we live in a society where we can easily associate with the opposite sex. So we have to do it in a very proper way, chaste way. Okay. In any case, when this important struggle for freedom is basically reduced to sexual freedom, and women become free to procure sex just like men, it is no longer advancing anyone, but rather degrading the entire society. In the strife of fanaticism and religious oppression versus sexual freedom, women as a class are left harmed. Although in many ways they are more free, they continue to be taken, even by themselves, as a sex object and to be used as a symbol for sexuality. The material sexual atmosphere increases their material sexual tendency and furthers them away from their devoted and loving nature. In fact, this transition between a saint and a prostitute is rapid for women, since these are two aspects of their prakriti nature. That is very heavy, and I'm going to read that again. The material sexual atmosphere increases their material sexual tendency and furthers them away from their devoted and loving nature. In fact, this transition between a saint and a prostitute is rapid for women, since these are two aspects of their prakriti nature. This is also the reason why they are not considered very intelligent. In the Vedic culture, an intelligent person is one who can distinguish between matter and spirit, while women are more easily swayed to identify their material body on account of external beauty. So, I find this very interesting that she's making the point here that women have these two potential natures, the saintly nature, which I believe she's referring to as the motherly side, the nurturing side, the loving side, and the other side, to be sexually free, which is synonymous with prostitute. So what does that mean? I'll tell you a story. Once Prabhupada was being interviewed, and he was, you know, the reporter, as they often did, they'd ask him about women, and he would say, as he often did, women should be protected. They should be married. And he'd say, women have three stages of life, which is to be protected by their father, or to be married, or to be protected by their son. So the woman said, well, what if they don't want to get married? And Prabhupada was saying, well, that wasn't referring to that as a stage of life. He said, no, there's three stages of life. So basically the conversation went around in circles with her asking that question over in different ways and Prabhupada answering it basically in the same way. And then when she left, then Prabhupada discussed this with his disciples. And she said, he said that she was asking, well, if a woman doesn't want to get married, so what status is that? Because she was looking, you know, to legitimize that status. Well, what if I don't want to marry? You know, you're saying she should be married or protected by the father or the elderly children. Then Prabhupada said to his disciples, he said, I didn't want to tell her, but that order is called prostitute. So what did Prabhupada mean by that? He meant, because she doesn't want to get married, generally for most women that means they're going to have boyfriends. And that means generally, unless they have some spiritual backing, spiritual determination or spiritual belief, if they so-called love that man, they're going to have sexual relation with that man, especially if they don't want to marry and they want to be with that person. So then Prabhupada said, that is called prostitute. Now, most of you have heard the story of Bilba Mangala Thakur. And the story of Bilba Mangala Thakur was that he was raised as a Brahmin, or he was born as a Brahmin, raised as a Brahmin, a very great devotee, but then later in his life he became attracted to a prostitute, and he would visit her regularly. And then there's the famous story in which his father died, and he was, during the funeral, thinking of this prostitute, and he quickly left the funeral, and it was a severe storm, practically like a hurricane, and he somehow or other crossed a river, ended up being a dead body that he was, thought it was a log, it was a dead body. And he had, you know, she had locked the gate to her place, so he had to climb over the gate, and, you know, it was like nobody in their right mind would be out there. Like they say in India, the sun in India is so strong you can get sick from it. And they say, no one will be out in the noonday sun except the Britishers and mad dogs. That's what they're saying. Because the British people, they didn't know that the sun would get you sick. Or they never see the sun in England. So when they're in India, it's like, wow, the sun, we can see sun, let's go out in the sun. So no one would be out in the sun except Englishmen and mad dogs. And so no one would be out on this night anyway. And so she told him, said, I can't believe you've come. You've got so much devotion to me. This is ridiculous. You should go to Vrindavan and give that devotion to Krishna. So that's a famous story Prabhupada tells. Now, the thing we usually hear that Chintamani, this woman that Bilba Mangala Thakur was seeing, was a prostitute. But actually, Prabhupada said later, not later, but in another conversation, he said, Chintamani was Bilba Mangala Thakur's girlfriend. So, in that context, or in this discussion within this context, girlfriend and prostitute, if that's what you're doing with your girlfriend, then your girlfriend's basically your prostitute. Interesting way to look at it, isn't it? Now, Spiritual Sky has another comment here. A similar situation happened a month ago in New York City. The Hasidic Jews wanted the bicycle lanes taken away on the streets because they kept seeing women in shorts riding their bicycles. They said it was getting in the way of their religion. They wanted this temptation taken away. I do not know the outcome of the situation. Wow, very interesting. Well, you know, I would think in a Krishna-conscious culture, you might be able to pass that through. At least if they rode their bikes, they'd have to wear something other than shorts. But of course, the ultimate solution is become more mature. I don't know. These Hasidic Jews must be having trouble on their way to work. You know, there in their religion, they women dress themselves with long skirts. So I guess, I don't know if they're having trouble, but they prefer not to see women in short skirts. Yes, as I said last week, you know, from the woman's point of view, they just think men are, they're just, you know, making a big issue out of nothing. But I think part of the problem is women may not fully understand how attracted men are to them, especially physically attracted. Men are very physically attracted to women, even if they want no relation with them. So it's something good for women to know, to be aware of, that physically you are attractive to men, and the more you dress down, the more attractive you become, or the more it becomes a disturbance to men, at least some men. Okay, so we're getting back to this idea that women have these two natures, the motherly side, or what she calls here the saintly side, and the sexual side, to be sexually alluring and attractive and, you know, as they sometimes say, feel sexual. So, you know, to dress up in a way that's sexually attractive to men. And Prabhupada writes about that in the Bhagavatam. He said that women in the age of Kali will dress in an overly attractive fashion to victimize the minds of men. As far as I understand from Prabhupada's teachings, in traditional culture, the women would only dress up in a very attractive way at home. You know, and I think today it's kind of the opposite. But what was the idea is that when their husband would come home from work, they would see an attractive woman at home, beautiful woman, so they'd feel satisfied and they'd and just feel more dedicated to their household life to see their wife dressed up and very attractive. And then when the women would go out, their idea was not to attract men. Their only idea was to be attractive to their husbands. So they wouldn't go out and try to allure or attract other men with their beauty. But that was reserved for their husbands. And in traditional Veda culture, there's a saying that said a woman would not even be seen by the sun. That if they'd go out, they used to go out in palanquins and they'd have curtains on them so the woman wouldn't even be seen. And, you know, for us, we think, well, that's really weird. That's a weird culture. And Girashami told me that he was preaching in Pakistan. And what happened is that Pakistan is a Muslim country. So I think it must have been around 1950. So then they divided India and Pakistan. So there were some Muslims left in Pakistan. I mean, that was still part of India. So, you know, the culture as it was in 1950 was that there was segregation between men and women. So Giriraj Swami said he did a program and they either had a curtain or they put the women in a separate room. So he was in a room, I believe it was a curtain, he was in a room and there was a curtain, and behind the curtain all the women were there and he couldn't see them. And he realized that that was a standard or in vogue around the 1950s. And because Pakistan had become separated from India, the cultural changes in India had not taken place in Pakistan, so they were still doing that. And that was considered normal. And Prabhupada says in the homes, women had separate quarters, like in the center of the house. And, you know, they had these joint families, and the women would live together and the men would live separately. So there was always a lot of separation in those cultures between male and female. It was just to keep everything safe, kind of like in a hospital or a doctor. He always washes his hands. It was to have to be safe here. So that was the idea. Now, we look at this kind of thing and we think, wow, this is really, really, really backwards. But look at what we're dealing with in our society. Abortion. So people want to enjoy sex. The byproduct is children, so just have abortion. Broken families. I mean, when sexuality is not controlled, there's a whole slew of problems that ensue. One of which is described in Bhagavad Gita as children that are not wanted. And when children are not wanted, they're not raised well. And then you get a population degrades. And also, what the Ayurveda says, or the Vedas say, is that the consciousness of the parents at the time of conception is transferred into the child being conceived. So a lot of parents conceive a child when they're drunk, or they're high on something, or a lot of them conceived of children that are not planned in the height of their passion. And so the children take on that consciousness or that nature. Whereas in Krishna consciousness, Prabhupada said, before you conceive a child, you should chant 50 rounds. And then the consciousness should be to pray for a child who is a great devotee and bring a elevated soul into this world and then train that soul in Krishna consciousness. So then you create a higher level of offspring. And so everything is planned. It's not just, well, I like you, you like me, and poof, there's a child. Everything is well planned and thought out. It's not done in passion. Okay. So Carol has a comment. I went with devotees to an Islam mosque in 2005, I think, and I was the only woman in the room. As I was photographing the devotee men at the event, later I was surprised when I left the room and was ushered into a back room where all the women were watching the proceedings from behind closed doors by a broadcast on the screen. Yeah, so that, you know, the thing that I've realized is that whatever culture you grow up into is just normal for you. So now we look at this and we think, this is really strange. I mean, maybe as devotees we understand it better, but even... I know even many devotees think this is strange or think that too much separation between male and female. Maybe it's not healthy or it's artificial or it can even backfire because there's so much separation, then perhaps we meditate on the opposite sex even more because they're so out of sight. Of course, that's not the intention of it. But you know, having lived in India, and particularly living in a village, you see how the women live, and you see that women really are really truly mothers. That's really, they see that totally as their dharma. And they don't see that as something inferior. I have to compete with the men and earn as much money as them. And of course, more and more it's going to become that way now. But at least in traditional villages, you know, their role is mother. That's what makes them happy. And, you know, being separated in the home, living together in a separate quarters, to them, it's no problem. That's fine. That's normal. That's the way it should be. You find in the Krishna book, when Krishna went to Dwarka, came into Dwarka, all the women went up on the roof to greet him. So that was their natural shyness, you know, to stay separate from the men, go up on the roof, not get too close. And they didn't feel like, well, the men are discriminating, they're making us go on the roof. They naturally would do that. They just felt that that was okay. That was the way it should be. And they, you know, they weren't suppressed. They weren't feeling they had to be equal to the men. And I don't think they felt that way because the men were not trying to put them down. But, you know, mother is worshipped. It's interesting, in Vedic culture, the kids, when they wake up in the morning, the first thing they do is touch the feet of their mother. So, you know, you have this angle of mother being respected in that way, in that culture. So naturally, you know, the women didn't feel perhaps how women might feel today. You know, right from the beginning, they're being respected by their children. So mother is venerated. We see every woman as mother. Okay. Let's continue reading. Okay. It seems, therefore, that a certain synthesis is required to reconcile the two extremes, oppression versus freedom. That would provide, on the one hand, complete freedom, and on the other hand, an environment free from sexuality. So we're dealing with this. Well, women are being oppressed, so So we want to be free, but that freedom comes out in sexual freedom, and it creates all kinds of problems. So now she's saying, so what's the balance? What's the synthesis? That on the synthesis would provide complete freedom, on the other hand, an environment free from sexuality. It should be a synthesis of a higher nature that would uplift us beyond the material plane and the attempts at material problem solving, which constantly yield nothing but new problems. The culture of Dharma, which connects one's psychophysical nature with one's spiritual nature and holds self-fulfillment as an ideal, creates the suitable atmosphere for real freedom, thus offering such a synthesis. So in other words, what's the real nature of the male and what's the real nature of the female? And when we understand what our real nature is and we live according to our nature, not some artificial nature, well, I have to, maybe the men may be thinking, well, I need to be more feminine, more empathetic, more compassionate. Of course, there's nothing wrong with that, but they may take that to an extreme, and the women take to extreme, I need to be more like a man, more independent, more powerful, more self-reliant, whatever. But to some degree that goes against their nature. So she's saying, well, according to Varnashram Dharma, we all need to find what our nature is and then live according to that nature. As previously explained, in material existence, we all try to experience the taste of being the Purusha, the master, despite being spiritually servants. That is why the culture of Dharma teaches how to transform the spirit of lordship into a spirit of service and views freedom as a journey for spiritual self-fulfillment, not as doing whatever I like and enjoying without limits. So here she defines freedom as a journey for spiritual self-fulfillment, just like we know we have independence. So why did Krishna give us independence? Well, ultimately Krishna gave us independence. Well, you could say he gave us independence so we could be separate from him. That's true. But that's not ultimately why he gave us independence. He ultimately gave us independence so we could choose to be his servants. So here she's saying, what's the real use of this so-called freedom that we're given? It's to become spiritually self-fulfilled rather than just, oh, I have freedom so I can do whatever I want. So that's basically, here she's making the point that the feminist movement is saying, hey, we've been held down and we're as good as you guys and we should be able to do whatever we want. So then that's a misuse of freedom. In such a culture, the human body becomes a vehicle. Each one of us acts in the world according to our tendencies and bodily skills. We currently act to satisfy our egos or our imagined Purusha nature. But if we perform the activities natural to us in a spirit of service, we will gradually be cleansed of this false ego and return to our original spiritual nature, the nature of Prakriti. In this spirit, others are no longer considered objects of enjoyment, but an opportunity for service. Generally speaking, as Prakriti, it is the wife who is responsible for the inner culture of the house, and it is she who creates the proper environment for relationship, even if she has her own career. This is interesting, because I was in a bookstore yesterday, and I came across a book called the Kama Sutras. And you would think, why would Mahatma read the Kama Sutras? He's supposed to be celibate. Well, I thought in my mind, there must be something in this book about women which might be relevant to this discussion. So I looked in the index about wife, and there was a whole section on wife. What is the disposition of the wife? And what we just read is how the Kama Sutras describe the disposition of the wife. The wife maintains the home. The wife is always pleasing to the husband. She dresses nicely, keeps the home clean. In other words, her whole duty was to keep everything in the home very, very pleasing, very clean, very amiable for the husband. Of course, then they said, then he'll be in a, of course, because it's Kama Sutra, then he'll be in the right frame of mind to enjoy sex. Of course, we know that's not the reason the wife does that. But what we find in Vedic culture is this is the dharma of the wife. This is one of her dharmas, to be the mother and the wife, to be a good mother and a good wife, to be the good homemaker, to raise good children, to keep the husband happy and satisfied. Because if all the men are disturbed, that's not good. If home life is disturbed, that's not good. The home life, peaceful home life, is very important for spiritual progress. That's extremely important. In any ashram that you're in, it's important that you're peaceful. If you're brahmachari and you're disturbed because you find it difficult to remain brahmachari, it makes it difficult for you to practice spiritual life. If you're a vanaprastha or a sannyasi and you're not renounced, it's extremely difficult to practice spiritual life. So in the same token, if you're in the grihastha ashram, if you're married, but home life is not somewhat stable and somewhat peaceful, then it makes it difficult for your spiritual life. So it's an ashram. So then the Kama Sutra talked all about the wife making the home life very pleasing and satisfying for the husband. Everything nice, clean, and how she should have a nice disposition and not argue. Of course, the women out there are saying, well, my husband's no great saint, so... and plus, I wasn't raised in Vedic culture. How can you expect me to be this way? And of course, we say, well, you know, you can only be what you can be. But the idea is there in Vedic culture that the female dharma too is to be pleasing to her husband, because that's ultimately her prakriti, her nature. And she's happy when she does that. She's not, you know, women are not really happy bossing men around. And I'll tell you, the men are certainly not happy when they get bossed around. Although, men, if you're smart, and your women and your wives like to boss you around, you probably should let them. Because if they like to boss you around and you don't like it, whoa, there's going to be war at home. Women, men don't like being bossed around, and you probably noticed that. But of course, sometimes they, and then the Kama Sutra said, he said, sometimes you may have to rebuke your husband, but they said, sometimes you can just do it when he does something wrong with a facial expression. Or you could look away and say something. So the idea is to be a little diplomatic when you have to rebuke your husband or when he does something. You don't like, but... Anyway, I found it interesting reading that, you know, because it's very much, you know, this, it just goes along with what we're saying. And you get the impression from reading that that's actually how women want to behave if the men are worthy of that. Okay. A husband and wife's commitment to each other in a spirit of service creates a secure and natural environment for spiritual growth and freedom. The freedom to fulfill oneself to the fullest extent beyond the momentarily, I feel it like it, I don't feel like it, of the senses and beyond the ego and the material conditioning. So that now we're redefining freedom. Okay, freedom becomes the freedom to explore our spiritual lives, rather than the freedom to explore our Purusha nature. The Vedic literature is filled with stories of great women who, on account of their loyalty to Dharma, attain the perfection of self-fulfillment. Gandhari, who blindfolded herself so as not to surpass her husband. Kunti Devi, who preached to her husband to abide by the Vedic injunctions and composed her famous prayers. Damayanti, who saved her husband, Nala, from a life of sin. Savitri, who thoughtfully released her husband, Satyavan, from the hands of Yamaraj, the god of death. And there are many other examples. There are also women who were great spiritual teachers and great composers, like the South Indian Andal, Mirabai Janavadevi, of Bengal, and so on. So it's really a question here of how the woman comes into her own, or what does it mean to come into her own, come into her nature. And we're here, of course, talking about coming into our higher nature. In fact, when the Vedic scriptures discuss the need to protect women, the intention is specifically in regard to protection from the sexual energy or sexual environment, which corrupts the feminine qualities and the entire society. This kind of protection is only possible when society holds motherhood to be the highest expression of feminism, and women as a whole are seen as mothers. This is interesting, because what did Chanaka Pandit say? Who knows what Chanaka Pandit said? How should we see every woman? Should we see women half naked next to cars and car ads? What does that say? You know, I was in the Atlanta airport about a year and a half ago, and I was preparing a course on sexual purity for men. And one of the principles for men in sexual purity is to control their eyes, what they look at. Because men are very much attracted to women through the eyes, through the sense of sight. They become sexually stimulated visually. They don't have to touch a woman. They don't have to talk to the woman. They don't have to have a relationship with a woman. Just by seeing the physical beauty of a woman, they become sexually attracted or sexually disturbed. So, you know, I was putting this course together, then I was in the Atlanta airport, and I went into one of the stores there to get something, and they had magazines. And there was a whole rack. Probably this rack was, 6, 7, 8 feet wide and 5 feet tall. And the only thing on the cover of the magazines on that entire 5-foot by 8-foot rack was beautiful women. And how do beautiful women dress on the cover of magazines? What do they like to show? We won't talk about what they like to show, but you know what they like to show. So, that's mother. And we're supposed to see women as mother. And so everywhere we're, as men, and even as women, we're bombarded by the women in these sexual, as sexual figures. And that, and then it's almost like, well, to rate as a woman, you have to be extremely sexual and you have to expose yourself to the world, and then you rate. So that's really completely contrary to what we're talking about here. Women as the mother. What is the mother? The mother doesn't go around half-dressed, showing herself off to all the men in the world. That's not the mother. Not at all. So she's making the point that if the women don't develop or don't connect with their real prakriti, their real nature, then this other side comes out, you know, the sexual seducing side. So then it becomes almost like, I don't want to say a game, but in a sense, like who's the most attractive woman on the block? How attractive can you be? How seducing can you be? And it's almost like, you know, women want to conquer men by their beauty. They want men to be attracted. And a lot of this, it's so deeply rooted and conditioned that women may not even be conscious they're doing it. But it's just the society itself that is creating this. I remember when I first went to India in, it was 1975. And as far as I remember, at that time, every woman wore a sari. And one of the things I noticed about the way women dressed in India is that no matter how beautiful they were, because of their dress, their mannerisms, they didn't sexually disturb me or hopefully anybody else. It was not the mannerism, it's not the vibe, it's just the way they presented themselves. As we said, the woman is meant to be sexually attractive to the husband because that's the man who is going to impregnate her with a child. That's the man she's going to enjoy sexually with. So she doesn't need to be attractive to other men who will then fantasize about enjoying her. That's not what she wants. So I particularly remember that, how, as opposed to being in the West, being in India, even no matter how beautiful the women were, it's just the way they presented themselves. You could see their beauty, but at the same time, it wasn't sexually disturbing. Whereas it seems that the vibe in America is the more attractive a woman is, the more sexually disturbing she is to men. And then that's good. That means you're beautiful. And what the women don't realize is that when you're beautiful like that, the men simply think about enjoying you. And you're already married. Because now, Bhaktin Carroll says, billboards along the highways, meat, gambling, intoxication, selling with sexual images of women, yes. One sannyasi had been outside of America for years, and he was driving to the temple along the freeway, and there were all these billboards with half-naked women selling something. And he turned to the other devotee and said, don't they know there's a sannyasi? Sannyasi is going to be driving along this highway? Don't they have any respect? Now, you see that in India. You won't see billboards like that. Not yet. You'll see them. They're India's catching up. Don't worry. They'll get there. But it's taking them a little longer. Sexual images of women on magazines that check out in grocery stores. All these images available to children also, yeah, and they're telling the children, this is what you're supposed to look like. And also the thing they're saying is, if you don't look like that, when you don't rate. So everything is, I heard this one lady say that the bodily concept is so great that you can see that if a baby is not attractive, people don't want to deal with it. They just want to stay away from it. She said she was a waitress, and there were two babies in the restaurant. One was very attractive, and everybody was all around that baby, and there was another baby who was not, and nobody wanted even to get close to it. So all these images of beautiful women. Here's another thing, very interesting thing. There was a devotee, used to be a photographer before he was a devotee, and he used to shoot models. And he said, some of these women, in order to stay thin, would eat paper because it would kind of make them sick or fill them up, and they didn't have to eat anything. Ladies, if you eat paper, you won't get fat. The new diet, Mahatma's new diet, very inexpensive. Just go and buy some Kleenex. Say four Kleenex for breakfast. You're going to have 12 Kleenex with a little salt for lunch. And then, you know, a few more Kleenex. You could put a little banana on the Kleenex for dinner, you know, just so you don't go crazy. And you'll lose a lot of weight. So they do these drastic things to stay thin. So then you have these women who are insanely good figures with these insanely beautiful lights and the best makeup artists. So they look like demigoddesses. And nobody can look as beautiful as they do in these pictures. And then all you ladies see that and you think, oh my God, I don't look like that. There's something wrong with me. And so now you'll spend all your money on creams and this and that. So you go to the gym and go on these diets and just go crazy to look like them. Then you get your weight down. And then 1 week you don't exercise and you eat a little too much. And then, oh no, I'm getting fat. And you're looking in the mirror and you're going crazy looking at your body. So this is what we've created, this insane society. Want to hear something really insane? That I was out at this antique. This guy was selling antiques, and one of the things he was selling was bottles of antique medicine. And this bottle of antique medicine was from the turn of the century, and it was a medicine to make you look sexually attractive. And guess what? All you women out there, listen to this. This is going to make you laugh. Guess what this medicine did? It made you fat. Because at that time, fat was considered to be sexually appealing. Why? Because poor people and peasants, they couldn't get fat because they couldn't eat rich food. So fat is a sign of being wealthy and healthy. It's still in India. Maybe it's changing now, but it used to be. If you're a little plump, that means, you know, you're wealthy. You can eat. You can eat ghee and butter and ice cream and cheese and all these things. So being a little plump and chubby is considered beautiful. And being really thin, if you go in the village, you'll see so many women. They're just eating rice and dal. They're not getting fat. They're super thin. So that was, you know, you're a village woman. You're thin, poverty stricken. And peasant women were considered, in European women, peasant women, they all had tan skin. So if you had really tan skin, oh no, you're a peasant woman. It's very ugly. And then one model, I don't know who it was, or some lady who developed some beauty line of products, she used to go out and sail on a yacht and get suntan. And so that became the standard of beauty, if you have a suntan. But before, it was the standard of the peasants. They all had the suntan. So, you know, beauty is also culturally affected. So now we're raising all these poor girls, grow up seeing all these beautiful women who they could never be as beautiful. They could never look as beautiful as them, or it's rare. One woman out of a few hundred or thousand could ever look that beautiful. But you're going to try for the rest of your life. What a life. And then all these poor young boys are seeing all these images, and now internet access, they can have this all. It's horrible. So, Spiritual Sky is asking, Prabhuji, is it still this way in India, women not allowed to show any part of their legs? I wish they had similar dress codes. No, it's all changing in India. It is all changing. On the streets, pants, jeans. Years ago, women didn't wear jeans, so that's common, especially amongst young girls. Short skirts are very uncommon in India, but you'll see it in the movies. When I first went to India, I never saw any girls in jeans. But now, the young people in India dress very much like young people anywhere in the world. But I didn't notice any. I mean, they might be wearing, I didn't notice any miniskirts. I probably would have noticed. I mean, short skirts, I probably would have noticed. Probably amongst Christian women, they may wear them. But amongst Hindu girls, generally they don't. They cover themselves. That's still pretty much. I wish they had similar dress code in the U.S. Most women who wear these kinds of revealing clothes are the ones who should be wearing this stuff in the first place. If you go to the beach, it will make you sick. Yeah, in India, generally, when women bathe, they're wearing their saris. And if you look at the bathing suits from the turn of the century in America, the women were covered head to toe. It's interesting, isn't it? You know, there was that sense that in public, women shouldn't show their bodies. The big thing is plastic surgery. Asian women getting their eyes redone, skin lightening, and also nose surgeries. A lot of Asian women are getting plastic surgery to minimize their natural cultural features. They want to have more European looks. Yeah, I was told that also in Iran, it's hard to get married, and women tend to have bigger noses, so a lot of nose jobs there. Yeah, you want to make a lot of money? Plastic surgery, yeah. And, you know, the other thing I noticed in India, like, you see a woman in India who's 60 years old, she looks 60 years old. You see a woman in America often who's 60 years old, they're trying to look 25. You don't see that in India. It's like in India, you know, they get married young, you know, by the time the woman's 50, she's already got grandkids. And so they kind of just accept that, you know, they're just, you know, after 45, 50, you're just not beautiful anymore. You're not youthful looking. So they accept that. But, you know, it's so hard to accept because in our culture in America, we worship youth. The youth is worship everywhere. Look on television, ads everywhere, People magazine, youth is worship. So as you get older, you want to, you know, if you don't look young, you had a problem. And if you can afford plastic surgery and you're in the public eye, yeah. It's important, especially if you're a female. So I see. I my prediction is that this kind of thing is going to create so many emotional problems for people, so many more emotional problems than we're having now. Just, you know, I'm not beautiful, and this society doesn't respect me because I'm not beautiful. You know, suicides will probably increase because of this. It's just, you know, my body is not the way. It's too short. It's too fat. It's the wrong proportions, and it just drives people insane. And then if you look at arranged marriages, well, if the husband, if the father and the wife are going to arrange a marriage, and so it's not like you're so worried about how you look because your parents are going to arrange a marriage, and looks are not really the basis of that marriage. You know, so it's interesting, isn't it? So we haven't finished reading the article, but I think we're going to finish it next week. And does anybody have any other question or comment before we leave this topic? It's really, you know, if you look at Vedic society, Vedic civilization, and Prabhupada talks about how one of the principles of Vedic civilization was sexual restraint, and how society could be organized in a way to control sex so that sex is used for the purpose of raising children. And it's planned for that purpose, and particularly for the purpose of raising elevated children. And when that's the principle, the theme of sex, then all this other stuff, all this you know, the glamour thing that we're going through, the importance of looking young and extremely beautiful, and that being one of the ultimate goals of life, and being frustrated if you're not, wouldn't be such a problem. Okay, we're going to sign off. Thank you all for listening. Tell your friends to come back. And the more women that can participate, the better. I'd like to get more female opinions. We're looking at this through the male perspective. So, as beauty is such a subjective matter, does that mean there is nothing we can call beautiful in this world? Yes, the lotus eyes of Krishna are so beautiful. And everything Krishna creates is beautiful. And as I was saying, there's a difference between beauty and sexual beauty. So, you know, because sometimes someone is very beautiful, but they're not sexually attractive. And you know, ladies, many men are not looking for sexually attractive women. They're looking for beautiful women who can be beautiful mothers, who can be beautiful people, who can carry themselves beautifully. They're, you know, especially devotee men, they may shy away from a woman who's too sexually appealing, because they'll think, well, if I'm around this woman, then I'll be thinking of sex instead of Krishna. So I think there's a difference between feminine beauty and sexual beauty, as we're discussing here, when a woman is trying to be seductive, that's her consciousness, trying to make herself to look seductive to men. I mean, she doesn't even have to try. Women, you don't even have to try, and you already are. You have to try not to be, but you're not. That's the problem. But think of all these poor men out there. They have such a hard time. Be kind to them. Cover yourself. Okay. Hare Krishna, and we'll see you next week. Thank you, and all glories to Srila Prabhupada.